You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen on Wednesdays, 5 o'clock after calendar, or from the podcast page at kptz.org. I'm excited today because we're going to be talking to a new novelist. Her name is Kira Jane Buxton, and the book titled Hollow Kingdom was just published in August of 2019. It is making waves in the literary world because it's told from the point of view of a domesticated crow named ST. It's post-apocalyptic Seattle, and it's just not another zombie book, however. It's a time when climate change threatens every creature's way of life, and it's a tale with an ominous and real warning. As ST says in the book, life isn't the same once you learn how deeply a tree feels. Well, welcome, Kira Jane Buxton. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, all these reviews I've been reading, from Booklist to Publishers Weekly, from great authors around the United States, they're all saying your book is fresh, unique, and different. I'm wondering how you feel about that and what makes them say that about Hollow Kingdom.
I think, and it's an extraordinary compliment. I think it comes from the fact that the novel is a sort of very different take on in dystopian fiction and a different take on the apocalypse. It is, as you said, it's narrated by a crow. I call him my crowtagonist. ST is a, you know, this domesticated crow who loves people. And he lives with his owner, Big Jim, and, you know, suddenly something happens to Big Jim, and basically his eyeball falls out, and ST sets about trying to, you know, figure out how to help him. And when he can't, he has to sort of venture out into the natural world, and ST doesn't believe in this. And I think that in general, apocalyptic fiction tends to look at a sort of pool of human survivors and focuses on their strengths and their, you know, trials and tribulations, and this idea that we as the audience can relate to or you know, hope to be one of the few that would make it in an apocalypse. Whereas this story is really not about people after the fact. This is about what would happen to animals and nature if something were to happen to the human race.
Mm-hmm. And this is something, you know, when the eyeball falls out, for example, right away, and it's a great hook. I mean, you laugh, and then you're horrified. And I have to say, dear readers, dear listeners, that yes, you will laugh, you will be horrified, and you will be inspired by reading this book. So I would love it if you would do a short reading for us, just so that people can get the feel of this book. We're not going to scare you. We're not going to horrify you, but we do want to give you the feeling. So would you be willing to do a short reading for us, Kira?
I would love to. I would love to, and I will try my best not to scare and horrify everyone. I'm going to read a little short section. Most of the book is narrated by ST, our crow friend, and then some of it, you know, is there are these interstitial chapters that are from other characters. This is ST here talking. He's sort of looking at the sunset and reminiscing about the way things were and how life has changed. And he's talking about an old friend of his whose name is Gubari, who is an African gray. And I should say that you know, ST's owner, Big Jim, taught him certain words and a lot of sort of very floral language, things I can't repeat. Even his name, I can't, what ST stands for, I can't repeat on air. But so one of the things is that mofos is the word that ST learned for humans. And he doesn't think of it as a derogatory term. He thinks it is a very reverential term for human beings. So mofos are people, and Dennis is his bloodhound sidekick. I suddenly thought of the only other non-mofo I was able to stomach being around. Gubari was an African grey, a bird who could count and do perfect impressions and articulate a dictionary of mofo words. A creature whose crackling genius so closely aligned with his mofo owners, he filled me with envy. I ruffled my feathers, shaking off the thought of Rohan, Gubari's kind mofo, who had taught Big Jim how to take care of me when I was a leaf-skinned nestling with cornflower blue eyes and a sugar-pink mouth. Back when I believed tiny mofos lived in traffic lights and clouds were flying cotton. I didn't dare imagine what had happened to the African gray and his owner after Gubari had sent me the aura message to stay inside my house. I just couldn't swallow any more sad thoughts. Dennis, the bloodhound, started to dream through snorts and thin whistles and a kick that whipped off his starchy blanket. I dropped down and gingerly covered him. I studied Dennis's breath and its vibrant clouds in hopes that he dreamt of better days. Perhaps of when we'd play chase around the green mountain sugar maple in the yard, a rambunctious game of tag where I'd pull his tail and he'd lope after me with a goofy smile, wrinkles lagging behind him. Big Jim watched over our frolicking, calling us a couple of goobers, and even the green mountain sugar maple and the crocosmias would shake with laughter. I missed the green mountain and its sweet voice, and how it erupted into the colors of a Caribbean cocktail come fall. I missed our tree in our home, how it would bleed sap when it recalled memories too painful to share because it knew that holding things in is toxic. I hoped Dennis was dreaming of those days. I lulled myself by reliving those moments, feeling the kiss of dandelion cotton on my wings as I tagged Dennis, "You're it!" and falling asleep to the sugary tones of the Green Mountain saying, "Renaissance, Renaissance." I woke before Dennis, breathlessly watching the sunrise baptize the skyline in buttery tones. What an act of beauty, of unwavering faith, something to look forward to each and every day. Big Jim always said that nothing worth a poop pile happens before 9 a.m., but still, I wish I could have shown him this. As beautiful as the sunrise was, my heart was a boulder in my chest that would make it hard to fly. All the winged, even fungus gnats, know that you cannot fly if you're carrying too much weight with you. It's a well-known adage, actually. The light of heart is free to fly. Woodpeckers inscribe it into a lot of trees, those vandalizing buttholes. I missed the sounds of Seattle, the percussive rhythm of people, the clicking of heels, the throttle of an engine, the throb of a subwoofer, the siren song of an ice cream truck, the babble of caffeinated conversation, how I had to cock my head to digest a different accent, and boy did I miss the invigorating chucka-chucka-chucka of a chopper tracking down a sneaky mofo. Lawnmower and motorbike and Beyonce, oh my. I missed tidy, fresh-cut grass. All this long, tangled turf and greedy green devouring buildings made me nervous and also made an excellent case for the Homeowners Association's strident rules. Moss, especially the Spanish kind, is a deadly conquistador, dampening the sounds and edges of the city right before my eyes. Mofos kept a tight order to things, the world cupped in their hand, squeezing when necessary. I thought of the Green Mountain again, about how Big Jim had to trim it yearly to stop it from taking over the yard, so that one day it didn't fall over and crush our house like a can of Coors Light. Our house belonged to Green Mountain now. Maybe that wasn't so bad. Maybe Green Mountain deserved it the most.
Wonderful, wonderful language, and we'll talk more about that later. But let's talk about your characters. Where do these wonderful animals come from? How did you imagine ST and bring him to life?
Oh, you know, I've sort of always been a crazy animal lover, and I think when we moved to Seattle was when I really started to be around crows and notice crows and start having encounters with them. And I started becoming very fascinated and went off on a tangent reading. I started by reading about ravens first. There was more literature about ravens. And so I started reading about them. But then I was still, you know, having these sort of daily encounters with crows. And I ended up having one encounter where I was walking my dog, and we were in Bothell, and I came upon this crow who, he was lying sort of in the street, and his wing was broken. It was sort of all the way backwards. And up in the trees all around were about 60 crows just, you know, screaming for their poor little friend. So I thought, okay, I have to do something. So I grabbed a box and I went to approach and thought, uh-oh, this is going to be my Tippi Hedren moment. But what happened was this little crow looked at me and I looked at this little crow, and there was this kind of understanding that this crow knew I was there to help. And all the crows around in the trees went totally silent. And I was able to scoop the little guy up, and I raced him off to a wildlife rehabilitation center. Very unfortunately, he didn't make it, which is really sad. But what happened then was I felt like the crows were following me, and I was having sort of little conversations with them. And, you know, there are so many, especially in Bothell, they have this sort of pre-roost aggregate where they all meet at the University of Washington, the Bothell campus.
I think I've read about that.
Oh, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And they go there and they touch down all over the campus, much to the chagrin of the groundskeepers, I guess. But then they all roost together in the nighttime at the restored wetlands, which are pretty much attached to the campus. And so, you know, there's the conservative number of crows that fly there every night. And, you know, we see them. You see those, like, river of crows fly overhead every night. That's 16,000 crows just in that one
murder.
Roost. Yeah, one murder.
That's right.
And so it, sort of unsurprisingly, I ended up having so many encounters and became very, very enamored of them and had wanted to write about crows for a long time and just didn't know how. You know, how on earth do you, and it was actually after a sort of long period of disappointments in the writing world and getting close to publication but not quite getting there, my husband said, you know, why don't you just go and write the thing about the crows? You've been talking about that forever. So I was in my car one day, and it sort of hit me, oh, what if it's actually from the point of view of a crow? And what if a crow is talking about humanity? And what if a crow is talking about the extinction of humanity? And I was so excited by the prospect. So I started, you know, I went home, started writing this chapter. And then I think it was probably, I was already writing. And ST sort of showed up as a very well-formed character. I'm a humor writer, so a lot of his voice is quite humorous. His take on things, his little miscalibrations about, you know, us, you know, our species, that was fun to explore. Mm-hmm. But I ended up befriending two wild crows who I spend time with every single day, and, you know, I spend more time with them than any other people, really, because I'm a writer.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, and the female is incredibly funny and goofy and a show-off and very, very sort of fun character, and I think she inspired a lot of ST's antics and the way he is, and certainly I got to see a lot of crow behavior up very close. So I used it. And then for the other characters, Gubari, the African gray, who's incredibly intelligent and wise. My mom, when she was living in Korea, she used to, I was going to say babysit, but parrot sit? I don't know if that's a thing. She used to parrot sit an African gray who used to do impressions of all his previous owners, and he'd had a few. So he spoke some Arabic. He could replicate an asthmatic voice because one of his own owners had asthma. He used to do these flawless impressions of people, which used to crack my mom up. And that, I think, is where the idea for Gubari came from.
Right. You use that to great effect in the story when Gubari is reminiscing about his owner and his owner's wife. That was very touching. This is Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Book Lovers Cafe. I'm talking to Kira Jane Buxton about her new book, Hollow Kingdom. And if you've missed part of this interview, it's really fascinating. You can find it on the podcast page and hear the beginning again. So your own pets, you have all the wild crows and the wild characters. What about Dennis the Bloodhound and some of the other dogs? There's a poodle who, when she runs, she says poodle doodle.
She does.
Poodle doodle doo. And she calls the outside world the potty world. I love that. I have a poodle that lives next door, so that's who I thought of.
Yeah, Winnie the Poodle was a really fun character to explore because she's sort of the quintessential pampered pet, the pampered poodle. And she was partly based on a real poodle I know. Winnie the Poodle lives in Bellevue, but the real Winnie lives in Berkeley, California, and is a very funny character and, you know, is a poodle who wouldn't thank you for a piece of meat and would prefer carrots. You know, she's really a vegetarian poodle. I mean, it's very Berkeley when you think of it. But I think I've always been very captivated by the idea that we tend to think as humans that we run the joint, that we sort of are the sovereigns of the planet. And we forget that, you know, we share the planet with a lot of different species. And I've had this extraordinarily lucky upbringing where I've always been around animals. And, you know, my first job was actually at a zoo. I was a volunteer when I was 12 and, you know, used to run around, have all these amazing animal encounters. And I was raised sort of both to think about the fact that, you know, animals are not lesser beings. They have these very complex personalities and ideas and feelings. And living next to a poodle, you know, this poodle has, you know, lots of opinions.
Yeah. So what about Dennis? Why did you choose the breed Bloodhound in this book?
Yeah. It's so interesting. I seem to be very fascinated by Bloodhounds. I've never owned one. I don't think I'm compatible with a Bloodhound. I'm far too lazy and they need a fair amount of exercise. And but I think I'm fascinated by the fact that they're sort of you know, I talk about it in the book as nasal acuity, you know, the fact that they have such an incredible sense of smell and, you know, how we've sort of used that in, you know, to help us with search and rescue. And that's always captivating to me. But Dennis's personality, I think, partly comes from a dog that my mom rescued, our family dog. His name was Douglas. And Doug, this was when we were living in Singapore, and Doug was a Singapore mutt, really. He was a mix. We never knew what he really was. But my mom found him one day. It was in the middle of a storm, and he was drowning in a storm drain. And, you know, my tiny English mother dove into a storm drain, basically, to pull out this 60-odd-pound dog. And he, you know, when he first came to us, he was on probation because we didn't know his temperament. You know, we were trying to figure out, you know, what kind of a dog, what's his history. And he ended up becoming very much like Dennis the Bloodhound, incredibly sweet and loyal, a good dog.
Right.
And I think many of us have good dogs.
Yes, I think Dennis is underestimated. When we first start hearing about him, we think of him as a dopey, lovable, and ST gives us this impression, right? That that Dennis isn't exactly really up to the beat. But then he becomes something of a hero, and we really appreciate him.
There's a lot of exploration of prejudice in the book, and these ideas, like, for example, Dennis, you know, we have this idea that he's a dopey dog, and then, you know, come to find that he's a lot more complex, even though, you know, we don't hear his language in the same way that we might hear the other characters.
Also in the reading, you mentioned the aura, and part of the really wonderful thing about this book is the idea of the way that nature communicates. So can you explain aura and echo and web and what those are?
Absolutely. So in the book, there's this idea of these communication networks. In terms of aura, echo, and web, I'm exploring the idea that there is a conversation happening in nature around us at all times, which is based in, you know, it's based on true research. Aura, ST sort of refers to it as the Twitter of the bird world. You know, it's what's happening, the communication network that's happening in the trees all around. Web refers to the communication network happening underground. and echo is what's happening under the water. And I had been reading, you know, I'd been reading Peter Wohlleben's The Hidden Lives of Trees,
mm-hmm.
and I'd also been so fascinated by this idea that there is this communication happening at all times under the earth. It's the mycorrhiza. It's the fungi network communicating and sharing messages. And aura, I get to witness pretty much every day. I have obviously the two crows that I hang out with every day, but I also sit outside and I sit with hummingbirds. I've got juncos. And I sit outside, and it's a sort of radical thing to do these days because it involves stillness and not checking your phone, and sitting there and just observing what's happening. And I know that I've seen that the squirrels respond to things the juncos are communicating. I've had it where I've been sitting with my crows and my junco. I have a junco named Jerry. He's a fun little character. Jerry the junco has done an alarm call, and what's happened is one of my crows, T, has shot up into the air about 60 feet and begun to mob a red-tailed hawk that was hiding in the tree.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's, I'm fast. I mean, it's terrifying because she has no, you know, she's just very gung-ho about going after eagles and raptors. It's very scary for me. But this idea that this communication is happening is so exciting to me. And I think that, you know, we've become sort of more connected to each other than we've ever been in terms of technology, which is a marvel and wondrous. But we've also become very disconnected from nature, and I think we've forgotten to tune in to those networks because they're there.
And it's a wonderful part of the book. I loved it when the trees actually joined into the aura as well and started pointing directions and giving some impulse to where ST and Dennis were headed for. It was great. And thanks for weaving that in. There's a lot of things about the natural world, factual things that you weave into this story. And did you kind of do the research along the way, or were these things that you knew about that you thought, oh, I'm going to talk about the ants and how they create a floating raft?
Yes, my editor would tell you, my wonderful editor, Karen Kostolnik, would tell you that, yes, I pumped the book full of animal and nature trivia, and it had to be scaled back because it was a little intense. She, she, at one point, I think she sent me a message like, I don't think we need to know how many teeth everyone has. And I was like, oh.
Oh, darn.
Yeah. But so I read about the natural world voraciously anyway. It's my, you know, it's a joy. I'm interested because I'm engaged with it daily and want to find the language, and I want to work on my tree literacy, and I want to know more about what I'm looking at and what I'm experiencing. So this gave me a wonderful excuse to kind of channel some of that, and I just would read anything I could get my hands on. I obviously read everything to do with crows, so like The Gifts of the Crow, everything by John Marsluff, who I know you've talked to, and you know, Lyanda Lynn Hopped, her Crow Planet. I read The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman, everything by Bernd Heinrich because he's brilliant. I read a brilliant book that I talk about a lot called What the Robin Knows by John Young, and it's a wonderful book that put into words what I think I've been trying to express myself, which is, you know, when you spend time in nature, you have to practice good, he calls it jungle etiquette, which I think is a beautiful way to express it. But it's this idea that we kind of walk around stomping and with our heads down, and we forget that we have a pretty big impact, you know, individually as we move around in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I watch people, they don't see the crows, or they, you know, I see that the birds are doing something, you know, on the ground, and then somebody will stomp up and not see the birds, and the birds will have to scatter. And we're sort of oblivious to what's happening around. So all of these things I just devoured and enjoyed. And then I would read voraciously, study, and then I would go to write a character organically as I could, and, you know, putting in the research, but also the personalities that I had learned about and the animals' encounters that I'd had. And it all was this sort of lovely and maybe, as you say, unique and maybe a little strange conflation of those things.
It's what made the book important for me as I was reading it. You know, there's not only the real factual information about our natural world, but there's the places in Seattle that we are familiar with. And there's also a lot of human products and things about our culture that are there. And it just makes the book really come alive for the reader. So as you were writing this book, what were your hopes for it? What did you imagine would happen? Because I know there's a lot of people out there that are working on their first books.
You know, I love to talk to other writers, especially new writers or hopeful writers, because I hope to inspire little hope. I spent 10 years trying to be an actress in L.A. and was pretty much, it was some pretty funny stories, and I definitely built my comedic chops there, but by and large, I was pretty much rejected across the board, or I would get a part and things would, it would, the movie would just get canned, or it was a tough time. 10 years of that is very difficult. 10 years of professional rejection.
That's how you learn to be a persistent person.
It is. It is. Like I say, I'm like the bedbug of writers. Just don't go away. But then I came back to writing, and it was really probably close to another 10 years before this was published. Maybe not quite 10, but close. Mm-hmm. And so that's almost 20 years of professional rejection. And I had been trying so hard to get published. That had been the goal. And I'd been writing humorous mysteries and had come really, really close. And then I over-edited a novel, and I couldn't see it. And I went away and wrote a sequel to it, came back. I still couldn't see it, and I still can't see this novel. And it was really, really hard. That was like sort of the straw, you know, and the camel situation. And it was my husband that said, you know, you need to go write the thing about the crows. And he gave me the best advice. He said, just have fun with it. You know, don't worry about outside expectation, and don't worry about trying to get an agent. That was my biggest goal, was to get an agent. And he said, don't worry about that. Just write something for you. Write something that you believe in. And at the time, I'd been so, you know, worried about, in the face of climate crisis, what's happening and what we stand to lose in terms of, you know, a million species. And I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about, you know, the what ifs, but from a place of hope. Well, and so I hope that's what the book represents. Hope that if you're a writer out there and you're struggling and it's hard, I get it. You know, I've been through it really for a very, very long time, and you can do it, and it will happen in the right way for you. And also hope that we can reconnect with nature and remember what a gorgeous planet we live on, and that the biodiversity is the very best thing about it.
Oh, thank you so much, Kira. We've been talking to Kira Jane Buxton, and she's been telling us about her life as a writer and her book, Hollow Kingdom. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I think we could keep talking to Kira for another half hour, that's for sure. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kptz.org. I'd really like to thank Alex for being in the booth today, and Carl, who is the editor who smooths out all the rough edges. Thank you all, volunteers and supporters who make this radio station possible. Keep reading out there. We'll talk to you next time.